Hello, and welcome to the Queen's Observatory Fast Radio Bursts. I am Connor Stone, here with my co-host, Nikhil Arora. It is our mission to bring exciting space news hot off the telescope and into your ears. One way or another, the Queen's Observatory has continued its practice of sharing the wonders of the universe since 1857. Thank you for joining us in this long-running tradition. Here at Fast Radio Bursts, we will answer your questions, interview astronomers, and dive deep into breaking research. From low Earth orbit to the clouds of Venus, from Betelgeuse to colliding black holes, it's a big universe to talk about, so let's get started.
And welcome back to Queen's Observatory's Fast Radio Burst. I'm your host, Nick Arora, and we are here with my co-host, Connor Stone. Hi, Connor. How are you doing?
Hi, Nick. I'm good. How are you?
I am good as well. So we are going through our series of The Living Universe. We are in our episode 3. In the last two episodes, we've sort of put forward to you a paradox which says that if there are so many planets in the universe, why haven't we seen life? That was the first episode. And then in the next episode, we tried to suggest some of the solutions to these paradox. And today we're going to sort of move forward into a more practical stream and try to answer some of the questions about, let's assume there is life in the universe, how do we discover it? What is being done in today's field to discover extraterrestrial life, to discover aliens? I think I said this once before in one of my interviews, I guess, Connor, that there are two popular things in astronomy. Black holes and aliens. We have talked quite a bit about black holes, and now we get to talk about aliens.
Yeah, those are always winter topics.
Yep. So that's the plan for today. We're going to sort of talk a little bit in detail as to what was done to look for life and what is being done and what are some of the future-looking plans in the field of extraterrestrial intelligence. Not really intelligence, life. So this would be the last episode for our series, The Living Universe. After this, we are planning to do a podcast series on the brief history of the universe itself. So we like to stick with the topic of things in the universe. So in this series, through multiple episodes, we are actually going to look at different time periods of the universe that sort of make the universe the way it is today. We're going to go through some significant periods and try to describe them to you, their importance and sort of the science behind them. And I think that
sounds like fun.
Yeah, I think that's going to be a lot of fun for sure. But that's for later. Let's actually dive into talking about aliens. So Connor, let's start with, I guess, the most obvious question on the board over here. Are we looking for extraterrestrials?
Yes.
Okay, moving on.
Yeah, so there's a bunch of different ways that we're looking for extraterrestrials or life or whatever we could find out there that might tell us we're not alone. Mm. There's a bunch of different ways that we go about this, and I think we can start with the shortest one, which is actively trying to make contact, trying to reach out to aliens. That's actually a pretty short section because the universe is very big, and communicating with even the nearest star would take years for every message to come through. Yeah. So that one sort of got stopped in its tracks. But in the 1970s, there were a few attempts that we can go over. The first one, which we actually mentioned in our Arecibo attribute episode, is the Arecibo message to M13. M13 is a cluster of stars. It's what's called a globular cluster. Thousands of stars all packed into a really tiny area. It's about 25,000 light years away, which is the main problem that I alluded to earlier. It's going to take 25,000 years for our message to reach them. So if there's any planets there, which more modern astronomy has even told us that there probably isn't. If there are planets there, it'll be 25,000 years before they get a message, and then they could send another message. Yeah. It'll be another 25,000 years before we get that back.
Yeah.
So the Arecibo message was not really, like, they knew that it would take 25,000 years when they sent it. So it wasn't so much a full-fledged attempt to make contact with an alien civilization. It was more of a symbolic gesture as a ceremony for the updated Arecibo telescope.
Yeah.
It had just undergone some remodeling, and they wanted to do something to celebrate it. And so they actually designed a message. By they, I mean Frank Drake, which we talked about in our first Living Universe episode. He came up with the Drake equation. And the message was also written by Carl Sagan. So together they worked out this message that we would send to M13.
Right. So I think a lot of people will be wondering this, and I guess you can answer that for us, Connor. What was on this message? What did the message contain?
Right. So good question. The message itself was just a few bits. I think it was 1,600 bits of data, which by today's standards, we wouldn't even have a measurement for that. You can't buy a USB small enough to just hold this message. And basically what this message was a grid of pixels that created an image when it was lined up properly. And we just kind of hope that the aliens can figure it out. But inside this image, which was a really low resolution image, there are the numbers 1 to 10. So that would sort of get the aliens started on our counting system and learning a little bit about our language. And then they have the atomic numbers for the elements, hydrogen, carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, and phosphorus. These elements are special because they're the ones that make up DNA. So it was sort of an attempt with a very low resolution image to sort of communicate a little bit of our understanding of the universe.
Or if the alien race is a little bit aggressive, all our secrets, might I guess.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, just knowing the set of elements that make up our DNA are probably not going to unlock the key to destroy humanity. So they also included some formulas for chemical compounds that make up the parts of the DNA, and a rough estimate of the number of nucleotides in the human genome. So basically, we're trying to convey to these aliens that complex life exists here on Earth.
Right.
Complex enough and advanced enough to sort of understand its internal workings. They have a picture of the double helix strand of DNA. They were really focused on the DNA a bit. Yeah. they also had some rough dimensions for the average height of a human, and a very rough, blurry graphic of a human. and then they had a graphic of our solar system and the planets and identifying Earth, because that's where the message came from. And then a little picture of the Arecibo telescope itself. One, to show that we have telescopes, which they could probably have assumed based on the fact that
we're talking to them.
We sent this message. Right. But also, this was a tribute to Arecibo, so that's why they included it.
Connor, of course, our readers can just like assume that we have notes for this podcast. And in the notes, you have colors attached to all of these parts of the message. So is there any significance to these colors?
The colors are really useful for separating the different sections. Okay. It's such a small image. Everything's kind of crammed together.
Right.
And so they can use color to keep the same size of image, but make it really clear when you're moving from one section to the next.
Okay, fair enough. Cool. So that's one. And I think that this one's pretty popular. I guess moving forward, we can again ask the same question. You've talked about one attempt to contact aliens or extraterrestrial life, might I add. Have there been any other attempts?
So another attempt, which itself was also more of a celebration of an achievement than a real serious effort to contact aliens, would have been the golden records on the Voyager spacecrafts launched in the late 1970s. So these records were made of gold for its stability. It doesn't really react with much. And they included on them hundreds of pictures and sounds and messages that basically were compiled from all around the world. They tried to make it really a time capsule of Earth. As you can imagine, it was pretty Eurocentric. but they did make an effort to include messages from cultures all around the world. So they included a variety of natural sounds. So surf, wind, thunder, animals like songbirds and whales. So they wanted to sort of include a little bit of what happens on Earth. They have a variety of greetings spoken in, I think, 55 different languages. Some of them ancient languages, some of them modern languages, but from all over, including one of them. Carl, just like with the Arecibo message, Carl Sagan played a big role in this.
Right.
So one of the greetings is from Carl Sagan's 6-year-old son. And it also includes sounds just from different parts of human life. One of them is footsteps and one of them is laughter. Both of those just from Carl Sagan himself. There were Morse code messages, which I don't understand why they put those in because there's no real way to translate that. There were printed message. There was a printed message from the United States President Jimmy Carter, and a whole lot of images. The first few images are very science and mathematics related, but that was really useful because including those images, along with a few connections to universal constants that any alien would know and recognize, meant that they could have a shared measurement scale for all the other images. So when they show an image of a elephant, they can actually include the size of the elephant relative to these universal scales. So aliens that have never been to Earth, don't know what a meter is or a foot or any unit of measure that we have, can still know the exact size of this elephant in the picture, which I think is really cool. They included a whole bunch of animals, insects, plants, and different landscapes. They tried to show some pictures of day-to-day life, and they were able to include the scale of time, size, and mass for a lot of these images because of those initial scientific pictures that they included. So this message contains far more information than the Arecibo message, but it was also transmitted in a very different way. It's basically a vinyl record that people used to use, except instead of vinyl, it's gold.
Yeah.
And it's attached to a spaceship, which has left our solar system. Now, there's no specific star that the spaceship is headed to. It's just going to be wandering in the universe. I think there's some point thousands of years in the future that it's going to pass within a light year of another star, which is far enough away that you would only detect it if you were looking for it and you were an advanced civilization already more advanced than us. So it's very unlikely to be found out just wandering out in the universe, but it will be there for millions of years.
Right.
As a sort of time capsule of humanity.
Yeah. Just as sort of an interesting thing to our listeners over here, both Voyagers still continue to make contact with Earth, as far as I know. So you can actually go on NASA's website and see for yourself where both Voyagers are at this moment, how fast they're moving, how far away from the Earth they are. And these are some of the fastest moving satellites that have been created, really.
Yeah, so they're both moving many kilometers per second, which is really fast. And they are still transmitting little bits of data back to Earth. It's very hard to communicate with them, but they can tell us a little bit about the environment that they're in. And that's how we know, actually, that they left our solar system, because they've started experiencing galactic winds instead of solar winds, which is really neat.
So I just looked it up very quickly. Voyager 1 right now is approximately 23 billion kilometers from the Earth, and it is moving at a speed of 17 kilometers per second.
Yep.
So quite fast. Voyager 2 is a little closer than to us. It's about 19 billion kilometers away from us and moving at around 15 kilometers per second this moment. So fast.
For reference, a bullet goes about 1 kilometer per second, if that.
Yeah. So.
So really fast.
Yep. Quite fast. Okay. Let's continue to move on here. I guess this is a good place to take a break then. I guess we've talked quite a bit about some past things that have been done to contact extraterrestrial life. When we come back, we're going to talk about some of the current science that is being done right now. We'll be back.
Hello there. I'm just stopping by to quickly let you know that the Queen's Observatory is always here to answer your space questions. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, and our website. Links to all of these are in the podcast description. We're always happy to talk about the universe, and if you ask a really big question, we just might have to do a podcast about it. I would also like to mention some of the other great resources out there. In the podcast description, you will find links to the McDonald Institute, the Royal Astronomical Society, and the Astronomy on Tap program. They are all excellent programs to bring the universe down to Earth. And with that, let's get back to it.
And welcome back to Queen's Observatory's Fast Radio Burst. We are talking about the current scientific efforts that are taking place to look for extraterrestrial life. So Connor, let's just continue over here. What are some of the current things that we're doing to look for life on other planets?
Yeah, so our grand ideas of the 1970s of trying to make direct contact, those are kind of on hold for now because it's become abundantly clear that there's no one close enough to have a chat with.
Or enough Hollywood movies have been made to scare.
Yeah, we've inspired enough Hollywood movies. We can carry on now to some of the more real world, like, all right, we actually want to look for aliens. How do we go about this? What's the best way to do it?
Yeah.
And I think the best place to start is with SETI, Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. So it's an organization. They actually started as a NASA program, but they've become their own institute. And they actually are quite an active institute. They run a lot of outreach and education about life in the universe. They employ astronomers and other scientists and technicians in order to run experiments that look for life out in the universe. Now, there's a complication with that because any signal coming from light years away is going to be very faint. And you don't know what frequency it's going to be in. You don't know what form it's going to take. Like how would an alien try to send us a message that we would recognize as something other than noise, right? And just like our cell signals, probably whatever signal it is going to come in at a really specific frequency. So there's a lot of different frequencies to check. There's a lot of different directions in the sky. You can point your telescope. It's actually a pretty hard problem to just figure out what to look for when you're looking for this extraterrestrial intelligence. It's entirely possible that there is a message being sent to us right now that no one's picking up because we don't know what to look for.
Yeah.
It's kind of unlikely because people have been trying this for a long time, but it's possible. If it's faint enough, we could very much have missed it at this point. There's also confounding factors that make it extra difficult because there are regular signals coming all the time from space. Those are our satellites that are communicating down here on Earth, and they're sending regular radio signals that look like they're coming from an intelligent civilization, because they are. They're coming from us. And then even further, there are repeating signals that come from space light years away. These are from pulsars. Mm-hmm. It's a type of neutron star that creates a very regular, like exact timing pulse of radio frequencies. And it, when they were first discovered, people actually thought it was aliens because what sort of natural process could create such a regular schedule that it was better timed than the best clocks of the day?
No one thought nature.
at the time when it was discovered, you would have been better off setting your clock by one of these pulsars than by the best clocks they have. But since then, we've got better clocks, and we've figured out that these pulsars are naturally occurring things that create a regular repeating radio signal. So there's a lot of stuff going on in the radio waves that you have to sift through in order to try and find this mysterious message from another world. So SETI, they're doing their best. You can volunteer with them if you want. They're certainly happy to include any volunteers that they can. They have lots of data to process and lots of data to collect. So it's certainly something... it's certainly a very active group looking for intelligent life.
Right.
And more scientific efforts funded by governments and in more like standard institutions, universities and research institutes, they are taking a different track. So they're doing experiments like the Perseverance rover on Mars. We did a whole series about that rover, and one of its primary goals is to look for ancient signs of life. So they're not trying to make contact or identify intelligent life. A lot of other institutions, scientific institutions, are really looking for evidence of any life, let alone intelligent life. So Perseverance is looking for any life that it can find, or any evidence of life that it can find on Mars. And you can hear all about that in our Percy Goes to Mars series. Yeah.
I want to emphasize over here, sort of, once again, the difference in the goals of SETI and Percy, for example. SETI is looking for intelligent life, so life that can actually communicate and do almost things that we do, whereas Percy and the other quote-unquote missions that we are going to discuss later on in this podcast are going to be looking for life, period. Now, this life could very well be microbial and bacterial in shape. We're just looking for just organisms just existing in that habitat.
Yeah, exactly. Another set of experiments that I find really interesting are the Kepler telescope and the TESS telescope. Both of these telescopes work by watching stars very, very closely. The TESS telescope actually takes a picture of a star every 2 minutes. So in astronomy, that's really fast video. And they watch these stars very closely, and they look for planets passing in front of the star and making it dimmer. And from that, we can get the size, the density, and the orbit of these planets. That directly doesn't tell us if there's life on those planets. But from those parameters and understanding the star that the planet is orbiting, we can actually tell if there's water, liquid water, on that planet, or at least the conditions for liquid water.
Right.
So this Goldilocks zone, we're looking for planets that would be in these Goldilocks zones around their stars. They could have liquid water, and liquid water, we think, is very important for life. It's hard to imagine life that doesn't use water, liquid water, in some way. So these telescopes are sort of a stepping stone to look for life. Now, if you want to actually find out if there's life on these planets, what you need to do is go there and take some samples. But that would be very difficult. We're not planning to do that anytime soon.
Yep.
Because, again, they're light years away. It would take thousands of years to get there. That's too slow. So what can we do in the meantime? We can point very powerful telescopes at these planets and try to measure what chemicals are in their atmosphere.
Yeah.
So JWST, a telescope that was just launched on Christmas. I got up early on Christmas Day to watch it.
Yeah, a lot of people did.
A lot of people did. And it's currently in the process of sort of powering up, unfolding, getting ready to do its science.
Yeah, it was and recently put into focus, right?
Yeah,
focused on
which is really cool.
Yeah.
And one of several missions that JWST is going to do is going to be looking for chemicals like ammonia and complex chemistry occurring in the atmospheres of some of these planets that Kepler and TESS have discovered.
Yeah.
So that's very exciting. Going to be happening very soon. Fingers crossed we'll have something to talk about in our space news. And obviously, finding ammonia in an atmosphere isn't a smoking gun, there's life on this planet. Yeah. But it would definitely amp up the scientific interest in that planet. Right. And we would be seriously thinking there's a possibility of life. You'd be seriously considering more experiments that look even closer at these planets. Yeah. We would know that there's something interesting going on there.
Yeah, as you just said a while ago, like if we find ammonia in one of these planets or any of these life-indicating complex compounds, we are not going to all hop up on a spaceship and say, let's go first for a summer vacation. Right?
Yeah.
Yeah, but what this is going to do is it's going to show us that this is not just a completely empty field, and sort of inspire more work and experiments into this.
Exactly.
Yeah. So I guess a very important question pops up out of this, Connor, which is, let's say we find something here. What would happen if we discovered extraterrestrial life? I'm assuming there is some sort of documentation on this.
So there's sort of two ways that we could discover extraterrestrial life. If we discover extraterrestrials on a planet that's light years away in a totally different solar system, then there's not much we can do except build more telescopes, learn more about the chemistry of this planet. Actually taking a picture of the surface of the planet would require telescopes far beyond our current capabilities. So it's unlikely that we would ever in our lifetimes see what's going on these planets, but we would be able to get a real sense of what sort of chemistry is going on there, which of course is a critical element of life. We would probably be able to learn a bit about the makeup of their chemistry. We would be able to tell if they're carbon-based or something else. It'd be really exciting, but it would be very indirect, which is maybe not as much fun as the second option, which is, what if aliens just come like knocking on our front door?
I'm guessing if that happens, there's someone sitting in an office going, oh, this is never going to happen. This is never going to happen. Oh, what do we do? Where's the memo for dealing with this?
Yeah. So if an alien civilization made it to Earth in their spacecraft, something to keep in mind is that their technology would have to be so far beyond ours. There wouldn't really be much of a comparison between us and them at that level. So some things that might immediately spring to mind is, oh, what if we're aggressive towards the aliens? It would be more like, what if ants are aggressive towards a human? It's like you more feel bad for the ants. I find it very unlikely that a civilization that comes to Earth would have any difficulty fending off even our most advanced attacks against them. They wouldn't even see it as a real aggression because it would be so easy for them to interfere. There's also a thought that has sort of come up in a whole bunch of sci-fi movies of, what if these aliens come to Earth for our resources? And by resources, we're talking about things like gold, platinum, lithium, sort of elements that are abundant here on Earth.
Right.
And the truth is, no aliens are coming to Earth for our resources. So those metals that I mentioned, they're actually not particularly abundant here on Earth. There are asteroids that are loaded up with more than we've ever mined. So traveling all the way across the universe to come to Earth just to take our resources is a silly thing to do. There's probably far more located in a few asteroids near their home planet or asteroids around any star. So there's not much advantage there. However, habitable planets could be very rare. And that is something that an alien civilization may find very interesting about Earth and want to live on Earth. But even then, it's hard to imagine them coming to exterminate us so that they could live there, because it's so much effort to move between stars. You probably wouldn't have a whole civilization moving between these stars. You'd have almost like a pioneering camp.
Right.
They wouldn't need the whole planet. So it's kind of funny. They probably wouldn't be coming from an aggressive stance. is really the main way, the main thing that I'm trying to communicate here.
Trying not to scare our audience here.
So, in fact, if they really need more land, it's probably more efficient for them to create gigantic spaceships than to go between stars. Yeah. It's much easier to create large spaceships than it is to go between stars. You can also imagine that any alien civilization has gone through a similar natural selection process as us. So they may have some of our good features and bad features, like humanity is a little aggressive towards the unknown. And that's fair. Probably any civilization which grew up through natural selection would have that in their sort of psyche. But we also know that modern civilizations are very aware of their power, and when they contact, when they try to make contact with people who aren't as powerful, they try to be very careful about it. There are uncontacted tribes all around the Earth, and we're very careful about how we interact with them. I imagine it would be more like that. The civilization, of course, would have some naturally aggressive elements, but they would have sort of grown past that as much as we have, or more.
Yeah.
Which is hard to say, considering current events. but on the whole, we're actually far more peaceful now than we used to be. True. And I can only imagine that trend continues. Now, maybe you'd want to know what sort of protocols we have for first contact. And if there are any protocols that countries have, they're secret. We don't know what they are. SETI has released some pre-established first contact protocols that they've already worked out. But those protocols are mostly concerned with making sure that the information is shared all around the world, that this is sort of a worldwide event and not a closed off, like one country is the portal.
Yeah.
So they are really focused on making it shared for everyone. So there's a whole bunch of things that would probably happen very quickly with the first contact. So the news would probably go a little crazy. Technology. What's interesting is, even if the aliens don't directly share technology, whatever mode they use to get here is going to sort of inform us of what are useful technological tracks to follow.
Yeah.
So we would actually get a lot of technological information from them just by their presence and studying them, let alone whatever they choose to share with us.
Right.
Things that they may not want to share with us would be viruses, and that would go both ways, right?
Yeah.
And there's sort of two ways that it can go. Either the virus could be like coronavirus, something novel that our system has no way to combat originally, and so it sweeps through the population, potentially causing a lot of damage. That's not good, but that has happened before when we've made contact with uncontacted tribes, and it's pretty devastating. The other option is, if their biology works very different from ours, it's possible that their viruses just don't know where to get a foothold, and they wouldn't be able to do anything to us. We'd be entirely immune.
Yeah.
It's an interesting thing to think about, but until we know how alien biology works, we won't know which one it's going to be.
You're living out a lot of Alien versus Predator movie right here, right now.
Yeah. There's so much sci-fi because it's such an interesting topic to think about.
Yeah.
Another thing would be communication. That's maybe the last point that I'll bring up about first contact. Right. Communicating with aliens, actually probably not as big a problem as one might think. Translating a language ultimately amounts to essentially code breaking. And any intelligent civilization, ours included, is going to be very good at code breaking. So there will be initial complete lack of communication, but as long as both parties are trying to communicate with each other, I think we'll very quickly establish a translated language.
Right. Okay. Cool. I guess that's a good place to end it. This has been a fun series. yeah. Thank you for listening to the Living Universe series here at Fast Radio Burst. When we come back next time, we're going to go through the history of the universe. But thanks for this, Connor. And we will see you soon. Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to the Queen's Observatory's Fast Radio Burst. We hope you enjoyed this walk through the universe. If you have any questions, don't hesitate to contact us via email at queensuobservatory@gmail.com. You can also follow us on Facebook and Twitter as the Queen's University Observatory to stay up to date. If you like this podcast, you can help us by leaving a review and sharing it with your friends. This will help us become more visible and spread the wonders of the universe to more people. That is all from us. We'll be back again with another exciting topic in astronomy.
And welcome back to Queen's Observatory's Fast Radio Burst. I'm your host, Connor Stone. I meant Nick.